Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Are you tricking or treating today? So anyway, my name is Bea Gonzalez. I'm the dean at University College, and I'm stepping in for Sandra this morning to introduce this morning's speaker. I already apologized to Rob, and I apologize to you. I can't stay for Rob's presentation because University College is introducing two new degree options at University College, and our Senate Curriculum Committee meeting was scheduled for this morning. So I'm going to introduce Rob and then scurry right out of here because I have to be at Maxwell by 8:30. So I'm already going to be late, but we'll be okay. So my introduction of Rob, let's go by the numbers. 79 inches. Tall.
Thank you.
197.5 million dollars in dollars coming in from the Central New York Regional Economic Development Council for five counties. Pretty impressive set of numbers. There I go. So Rob said keep it short. So here's what he wanted me to tell you. Because he's tall, he wanted me to keep it short. He grew up in Utica. He lives in Syracuse. He's a family man. He went to Maxwell. He's one of ours. Thank you for everything you do, Rob.
Thank you, B. That's definitely the best introduction I've had in a very long time. I appreciate it. You know, it's funny, when Sandra reached out, she had asked me to put together a presentation, sort of an update, if you will, on the Regional Economic Development Council, give an overview of what our playbook looks like. As Bea mentioned, we've been pretty successful over the course of the last two rounds. There's a round three right now going on in across the state, where we're in competition with nine other regions, fighting for resources on a competitive basis to continue to build and grow our economy. And then you wake up on mornings like this, and you go on Syracuse.com, for those of you who did, and welcome to my world. There is no playbook. I mean, we have a plan, and we have a strategy, and it's a good plan, and it's a good strategy. And there are a lot of people, some of whom are in this room, across the region, around the state, who work like heck to implement this strategy. But there are some things that are just beyond our control. And it's frustrating. You know, for me, for many of the folks who are involved in this work, it's frustrating when you have a global company that's very important to this community, that employs a lot of people, that makes top-line decisions outside of Syracuse in a corporate boardroom or in a accounting office somewhere that have a huge impact on this community. Now, we have time with Lockheed. We'll talk about it afterwards. I'll be happy to answer questions. We are going to do everything in our power to make sure that they see the benefits of being here and that they look at this place not as a place they want to divest themselves of, but a place that they want to build and expand and grow. So that story is not written. It's certainly not over. But it is a reminder, I think, certainly for me and probably for everyone in this community, that no matter how good of a strategy you have, how much sound data it's based on, how clear of purpose we are in going after it, things change quickly, and we have to be able to adapt to it. So with that, the first question I get when talking about the Regional Economic Development Council really is quite simple. What's the plan? We've won 2 years in a row. There are only two regions in New York State that have emerged victorious from this council process. In both of the first 2 years that the governors run this competition, ourselves in the North Country. I don't think it's any accident that those two regions have been ourselves in the North Country. If we have one region with whom we collaborate exceptionally well, where our plans and our strategies have been built together over the course of the last, probably the last decade, it is our friends up in the North Country. And there are a lot of core assets that remain. But the fundamental strategy is this: build on what we have. We have some really robust and remarkable industries here in Central New York. One of the challenges with an economy like ours is our economy is so diverse. Actually, we have 13 different industries that are somewhere between 5 and 9% of total regional employment. To give you a sense in comparison, a community like Memphis, 42 to 43% of their total jobs are in one industry, in transportation, logistics, and distribution. So we have a very, very diverse economy, which serves us well in challenging times. It also makes it a little bit more difficult to grow in robust economic times. But we believe that it's really important to build on what we have: agribusiness, radar and sensor systems, environmental technologies, medical devices, places where we do have skills, expertise, and a competitive advantage. Two, we've got to recognize that we exist and operate, as the headline this morning reminds us, in a globally competitive environment. Things outside of central New York impact our economy as much as things inside central New York, and we have to be able to adapt to that. Companies have to be able to innovate, develop new products, improve their processes, reduce costs, stay competitive, and ultimately they have to be able to get their products, not just to residents here in our region and around the state, but 95% of the consumers in the world live outside of the United States. So we have to be selling into those markets if we're going to be competitive. And third and finally, recognizing that while so much of economic development, community development, feels like it happens at the macro scale, we're talking data and industries and numbers, that myself, all of you, we live at a very human scale, right? We live in a home, in a neighborhood, in a community, and what that community looks like and feels like has a tremendous impact on our desire to live here, our desire to work here, to be productive here, and that we have to be continually making investments in the places where people and business live and operate. So B just mentioned a little bit of the numbers, $197+ million that we've been able to secure over the course of the first two rounds, more resources through this process than any other region in the state. All told, we have a tremendous track record of implementing those projects. And we hear, and I've certainly heard stories time and time again about economic development resources and projects that get announced and nothing happens. I tell you, we have the best track record of any region in New York State right now for implementing and carrying through those projects for which we have asked the state for resources. And unavoidably, there are some that have fallen apart, companies that have turned down the incentives that the state has offered. But for the most part, 92% of our projects are either completed or on track at this point, which we feel very, very good about. Maybe most importantly, the private sector investment. This is what we're always driving at in our work, getting our businesses here in this region, whether they be small or large, to invest capital in our communities, in their facilities that put people to work. And all told, combined between the state and private investment, more than $1 billion in just two short years. So I'll just give a quick overview of a couple of the key projects that I think are illustrative of the types of applications we're seeing. I mean, one thing that that people need to realize, a lot of folks, some folks in this room who are on the Regional Economic Development Council, there is so much work that those volunteers put into this process. In each of the first 2 years, we've gotten 300-plus applications for funding, and you saw that we have prioritized in any given year somewhere around 30 projects. It gives you a sense of how much work goes into reviewing those applications, determining which offer not only map to our strategy, but also that offer the best return on investment for the state. This is one of them, a very exciting project out in Auburn, really building on what we're seeing as a resurgence in our agribusiness industry. Cayuga Marketing building essentially a powdered dairy facility. So they're taking milk from dairy farmers in Cayuga County. They are powdering it. 70% of what they're making there is being shipped overseas, primarily to China. There is an increasing global demand as population rises for food. We happen to have a region that has a tremendous amount of land. We have tremendous amount of farming expertise. And if we are smart about it, for the first time in our long history, we can capture the value added from processing and production that goes into that, where there are a lot of jobs and a lot of economic opportunity for the region. St. Joseph's Hospital did a major expansion, actually a recipient of a major first-round investment. This project was interesting for two reasons. One, we're all watching the challenges and the changes happening in the healthcare industry. Healthcare is a tremendously important sector for our region, 23,000 people employed in healthcare in our five-county geography. But as importantly, it's the work that St. Joseph's is doing on the human scale, the investments that they're making in their neighborhood to make their campus more open, to work with residents, to build entrepreneurs in that neighborhood, that has a significant amount of impact on the funding of this particular project. great company down in Cortland. Those of you who may not know, Paul actually headquartered down in Long Island. They have a manufacturing and R&D center here. They wanted to build a research and development center of excellence for water filtration right here in our region in Cortland. So they had applied for some small level of assistance to get that, and in the process creating very high-paying engineering jobs right here in Central New York. It's one of my favorites. We have a company here in Central New York that nobody knows about that has components on the Mars surface right now. DLI, Dielectric Laboratories, out in Cazenovia, a remarkable company, a company that is growing perhaps more rapidly than any other company that I know of in Central New York. They do remarkable technology development. Filters, essentially, to filter out radiation for communications equipment is one of their primary lines of business. They have components on the Mars rover, and their employees are so proud of the fact that they have components on the Mars rover, as they should be, as our entire region should be. As a part of their project, they invested several $1 million. They created about 60 new jobs. This is a company that is far from done for growing here in Central New York. So we have the traditional projects that come in, right? I told you we get 300 applications a year. Our collective feeling on the council is that we need to do more than just react, right? Being able to evaluate these projects, being able to map them against a set of goals and evaluate which of these projects we think are real, which ones offer the best return on investment, which ones map to our strategy is great. But at the end of the day, it is not sufficient to just react to projects if we want to build and grow a sustainable economy here. So we have what we bill as 8 major transformational initiatives, things that we feel are critical to the long-term success of our Central New York regional economy. These are initiatives like Say Yes to Education, things that are really important to our urban school district, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And food to markets. I talked about the sort of growing opportunities in agriculture. We're also seeing a lot of shifting in agriculture and food towards more localized distribution and more localized markets. And there are massive opportunities to connect our local farmers with primarily our major institutional buyers of food. So think about the hospitals. Think about all the higher education institutions in this region. And they've been actively working with individual farmers and with co-ops to try to create a better connection for local produce that not only saves transportation fuel and energy, but puts more dollars into our local economy. Another really important initiative, in previous speeches I've talked to you about the venture capital desert here in Central New York, and I've shared statistics from the Brookings Institute, right? The per capita average of venture capital investment in Central New York, or in the nation, is about $1,000 per capita. Central New York, it's 23. Right? So we have a major challenge there that needs to be addressed. And at the same time, in places like the Syracuse Technology Garden, which is 100% occupied and has a waiting list of companies that want to get in, through schools like Syracuse University, Clarkson, and Cornell, we're seeing a really remarkable resurgence in new startup businesses. Many of them are high tech. Some of them are in digital media. There's a lot of really remarkable innovation that's taking place. And as these companies are coming out of the programs that we ourselves have built for them, they're finding that they have to turn to other places for the capital to grow their business. So they're getting investments from Boston. They're getting investments from New York City. They're getting investments from Kansas City. I don't know how Kansas City got into one of our deals here, but I can tell you that as soon as they did, I, for the first time in my 10 years in Central New York, I got a phone call from an investor in Central New York who was mad that we had allowed someone in Kansas City to invest in one of our companies. And this happened to be someone who we've been having this venture capital conversation with for a period of 5 or 6 years and had shown no interest in investing in any of our local companies. We're turning that around. With the support of some of the people that we have here in the room, we're in the process of building a regionally based venture fund that is going to be, for the first time, going to be capable of investing in these deals in our homegrown businesses, not only to help them grow their business, but to help them stay in Central New York, and maybe most importantly, to create new wealth here in the region, something that we have to be focused on as we watch this transition from multi-generation family-owned businesses that's taking place in Central New York. Broadband, another critical thing. Mentioned Say Yes. There is no way that any of the work we do here can have a long-term sustainable impact if 50% of the kids in the city schools can't graduate from high school. right? Every one of these investments, the $200 million in state investments and the $1 billion in private investment and all the great things that Greg Tripoli is doing at OHA and that we're doing in economic development, arts and cultural institutions, if that remains the status quo in our community, we will never pull ourselves out of where we need to be. My opinion, I think it's grounded in fact and reality. And we have 55% of our young people who live in the city under the age of 18 who live in poverty. Not sustainable. So initiatives like this are critical for us if we are going to be successful at building a growing, robust, equitable community. So our perspective has always been it's really important to not just to be asking the state for resources on one hand, but that we as a community have to be making investments on the other hand. That this, after all, is our community, it's not the state's, that we have to have ownership. And so that comes through things like investing in the venture fund, you know, SRC making a $5 million investment, the Community Foundation making multiple investments in Say Yes to Education. We have to put our own money where our mouth is if we want to be credible in asking the state for resources. So I mentioned our implementation progress, projects on track, you know, 92% track record, which is very good. We also have within our plan, we also have a pretty robust strategy for how we're going to go about building our particular industry sectors, for identifying new markets and new opportunities for the region. And each one of those strategies that we put together in this, you know, 75-page plan for Central New York has a team of people who are responsible for working on implementation. And this is one, you've probably read about it in the newspaper. There is a massive and growing market for commercial applications for remotely piloted vehicles. So this is not, you know, this is not military applications. These are things like agriculture. These are things like search and rescue, and a variety of other applications. We have a lot of the core competency within our companies here in Central New York that's required to help make this integration of these remotely piloted vehicles into the commercial airspace possible. And the FAA right now is looking for 6 spots in the U.S. to test and demonstrate the viability of those applications. And we want to be one of them here in Central New York because we see the long-term economic impact that it could create. Talked about exports, 95% of our consumers outside of the United States, 87% of the global growth happening outside of the United States right now over the next 5 years. Maybe the most shocking statistic and the one that hopefully will illustrate to you why we're spending as much time and energy on exporting as we are. Today, the U.S. is 21% of the global middle class. Okay, think about that. Massive share. By far, the dominant share. I think the next largest is 7%. In 2030, so we're 17 years from now, the U.S. is going to be 7% of that global middle class. Brazil is going to be 18%. China is going to be 21%. India will be 23%. Now, some people look at that and they get terrified. Oh, is the U.S., all these countries are passing us and dominant. That's not really what's happening from my perspective. And in fact, in that shift, I see a remarkable opportunity for Central New York and for the entire country. For the last 100 years, these countries, which have been developing their economies, have been doing it on the backs of our middle class. It's been U.S. consumer spending that has been driving the growth in China, that's been driving the growth in India, that's been driving the growth in other countries around the world. And now we have a world economy that will add $18 trillion in new wealth over that 17-year period of time. And that is wealth that our businesses have the opportunity to compete for. So for the first time, the tables have turned. We can build our economy on the backs of someone else's middle class. We can eat their lunch for a change. I think that's a really great opportunity for us. But we have to be smart about going out and capturing and tapping these markets. All of our investments, I think it probably goes without saying to this group, any of you who've walked through or driven through or spent time in or gone out to dinner or gone to the Landmark Theater in our downtown over the last 2 years, there's a remarkable transformation that's going on. It is real. It is tangible. The things that people have been talking about for a decade are coming to fruition. the work is far from done, but over the last 2 years alone, we've seen $1.4 billion of investment in the inner core. It's a remarkable number. That's a bigger number than in Rochester. It's a bigger number than in Buffalo, and these are communities that are much bigger than ours. And this is the result of, unequivocally, the result of partnership of the city and the university and our healthcare institutions and the business community and our arts and cultural organizations all working together to prioritize an economic strategy that builds from the inside out. Right? That level of prioritization has meant resources going in to projects. It's meant focus. It's meant attention. It's meant cutting through red tape when red tape needs to be cut through. And it's having a tremendous effect on the vitality of our community. We had a group of folks who came in from Buffalo yesterday and toured some of the projects that are going on. They wanted to learn what's happening in Syracuse because they want to replicate it in Buffalo. That's kind of a nice feeling for a change. We go out all the time to learn from other communities that are being successful, and now we're seeing communities wanting to learn what we've done in our inner city. So our next plan, you all probably saw a story a couple of months ago. We've submitted our round three application to the state of New York. We expect decisions will be made somewhere around December 10th, 12th, somewhere in that area. We're hopeful. We put another good list of projects together. Great companies that are looking to expand in just about every major industry here in Central New York. 35 projects in total. All told, about 810 new jobs if all those projects were funded and they come to fruition. And several hundred million dollars of capital investment. The bottom bullet is maybe the most important. You know, as we take this 300 applications and we narrow them down and we send a list of 35 to the governor, the thing that we spend the most time on is making sure that every single one of those projects lines up against our strategy. So we're not doing one-off funding for projects that don't tie into our broader goals, right? 100% of the projects advance at least one of those three key strategic goals. 75% meet at least two of those strategic goals, and a large percentage of them, almost 20, 25%, meet all three. That's a pretty significant shift from the way economic development resources have been allocated in the past. And while this process is not perfect, I think it has brought a level of ownership and local control to how state resources are spent in our community that I particularly think has been beneficial. A lot of new things in the plan this year, and this actually emerged out of our strategy last year. When the governor came to town in, I guess it was October of last year, we had to present him with a similar presentation about what's happening in Central New York, what's working, what's not. And we were the only region in the state that stood up and talked to the governor about the poverty rate in our region and about the significant challenge that created for our long-term economic competitiveness. And we had a dialogue with him and his people about what that meant and what we were trying to do to overcome it and the holes that we still had. And so as a result, the governor and his people put in their requirements that every single region around the state now have a plan for how to begin thinking about distributing and spreading the impacts of these economic development projects across our community, something that's pretty critically important. Innovation hotspots, they want to link all these early stage incubation services that are going on at SU and the Tech Garden and a variety of the Southside Innovation Center. They want regions to link those assets together, so we're in the process of doing that. Big push from the governor this year on sustainability. Won't spend a lot of time here, but this is something that I think you all are going to be hearing more about in the coming months. Our core message to the state this year, though, is that we are leveraging their investment, that we have been in Central New York great stewards of the resources that they've invested, that we're not just asking them for resources, but we are investing our own resources, and that we are taking the resources that they've invested in these projects in our region and in our communities, and we're leveraging them. We're going after foundation resources to do things in our neighborhoods. We're going after federal competitive grants to build new markets for our local employers. We're using resources to go to trade shows in Singapore and in South Africa where our companies have opportunities to sell products and create jobs right here in Central New York. One of the other things that they've asked us to do is to really focus on making sure that we find – this is – in my perspective, this is long overdue. We're 3 years into this competitive process. The idea of a competitive process for spending economic development dollars makes a lot of sense, right? In some ways, it does force us and every other region to bring your best projects forward. But at the end of the day, the North Country is our partner. Mohawk Valley is our partner. Southern Tier and the Finger Lakes and Western New York, these are communities where we cannot fall back into a parochial mentality where it is us against them. It's not us against them. Our communities are inextricably intertwined, right? That multi-billion-dollar investment in Utica and nanotechnology is going to have a ripple effect in Central New York that we probably can't yet understand, and vice versa for some of the projects that we're investing in. So the governor's finally asked us to codify how we're going to go about identifying those opportunities to work with other regions, building systems and processes to continue and expand on that so that we aren't working at cross-purposes competitively, but that we're working together. Probably the most important slide. We have a dashboard that we hold ourselves accountable for, and that every time I have to stand in front of the governor with Nancy Cantor, we present to him. It's clear, doesn't change. Little green arrows and little red arrows, pretty simple, right? What's working, what's not. What you find is that private sector job growth is actually happening here in Central New York. We've seen since we started this process, and this is not necessarily directly related to the Regional Economic Development Council, but our economy is growing. It's not growing rapidly. It's not as robust as any of us would like it. But in the context of the national economy at this point, 1.6% growth rate is not bad. Our metro product is growing. Our educational attainment is growing. For the first time in more than a decade, our average wages are growing at a more significant pace. And that's really important because our average annual wage has sort of hovered about 20% below the national average for a very, very long time. And we're finally beginning to see incremental uptick. But here's the frustrating thing. At the same time that we're seeing private job growth and we're seeing some measured growth in other key statistics, educational attainment and wages, we're seeing a massive change in our region's poverty rate in the wrong direction. So we're growing wages, right, which should indicate that we are that more money is moving out into the economy, but yet the level of economic inequity continues to grow. I'm not standing here telling you I have a solution. We have a lot of things that we're working on. I know many of you in the room are working on, but it's a real challenge. Some of the key things that I'll just leave you with, and things that keep me up at night, aside from the frustrations on Syracuse.com this morning that I've been losing sleep over for the last 10 days, these are all people related. You look at that, you know, when I lose sleep over our economy, it's really about people. Now I lose sleep over the 1,700 people who have a job at Lockheed, right? I'm not losing sleep over Lockheed, the global corporation. They're going to be fine. They have record profitability. But the people in our community. But our businesses are starved for talent. I don't go a day where I don't talk to one of our members who can't find the people that they need to do the work. And it's not as if our community lacks for talented people. We have a highly productive workforce. We actually have a very well-educated workforce. But there is a massive misalignment in two different ways. Where the jobs are and where people live, right? There's a spatial misalignment between employment and employee that creates real challenges for us. And this has been caused by some of the sprawl over the course of the last 30 years that we've talked about time and time again. But there's also a skills misalignment. The skills misalignment is getting worse in a lot of respects as we have failed to figure out how to bring our students, particularly in the inner city, along with an education. And the economy is changing. I mean, 30 years ago, 75% of the jobs in the U.S. required nothing more than a high school diploma, right? In 3 years, 62% of the jobs in New York State will require a college degree or more, right? So this shift is something that we have to be particularly aware of. We have to have a workforce that is competitive. If we can't provide employers with a workforce that is skilled, that is prepared, that is dedicated, then other regions will. We've seen that. We fight this. We've won some projects because of our workforce, and we've lost some projects because of our workforce. This is an area where our community has to have its act together. There's no easy solution. You cannot just focus on providing people skills. You have to understand what the opportunity is, right? Training someone for a job that doesn't exist in this community is a waste of resources, and we do it every day. Every single day that happens, time and time again. And there are there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars that are wasted in that system. And this isn't a criticism of any one individual or organization. We're as responsible probably as the next person. But it is a real challenge that we have to improve. The good news is there are resources out there, but the disconnect between our workforce and our employers has to be bridged. We need a translator in the middle who can help them understand, who can aggregate employment, build skills training programs directly for those jobs. And we also have to have an eye out over the horizon for what types of employment are going to be coming, not just a year from now, but 3 years from now and 5 years from now. So for those jobs that require long-term planning, that we have the ability to adapt. So that's where we are. I think mostly it's a positive story. The number of positive comments I've gotten about Central New York over the course of the last 2 years, more in the last 2 years than the last 8 years I've lived in Syracuse combined. Right? I don't know what it was. I can't point to a moment in time. I remember walking down the street one day and through downtown, going to lunch, and a friend, somebody who I hadn't seen in 3 or 4 years, walked out of the Chase Tower building. And I was going one way, he was going the other. We hadn't seen each other, so we stopped, and I went to shake his hand and say hello. And he didn't shake my hand. He came up and he hugged me. And I was like, okay, great. And he just said thank you out of nowhere. And, you know, his appreciation probably somewhat misplaced, right? The thanks for the work that's gone on in this community doesn't rest with any one individual, any one different organization. But this person who is an advocate for this community, who's been frustrated by this community for a long time, they were seeing signs of change, right? So I measure the success of our community through the eyes of other people, people who don't live here, people from Buffalo who come here, people who've lived here forever and who feel momentum. Doesn't mean the work is done, far from it, but there's been positivity. And that's something I think we have to figure out how to continue to build on. Despite headlines, despite challenges, we got to build on that because it's something pretty good.
Can you address those headlines? And the story is about a secret plan to close Lockheed Martin.
Sure. Secret plan to close Lockheed Martin. I will address it specifically to the extent that I can. We work very closely with Lockheed. As some of you may know, back in 1994, 95, when Martin Marietta and Lockheed were merging, there was a serious threat to the facility, the old GE facility, Electronics Park. And there was a plan to shut that facility and move those jobs elsewhere. And it was the business leadership and the civic leadership and the political leadership in Central New York that, and within the state of New York, they went out there and crafted a plan with Lockheed Martin to keep that facility open. The state took title to the property. They leased the property back to the company. They basically made an attractive arrangement for the company to stay. And that's worked well for now, you know, since 1996. Anytime you have a global company that isn't headquartered here, the decision-making is more difficult. The people who drafted said secret plan, whether it was anything more than a draft, whether it was a serious plan, whether it had sign-off from corporate executives or whether it didn't, all of which remains to be seen, there was a plan. Somebody had put that down on paper. Someone had done the math. Someone had done the analysis that of all the facilities in Lockheed's footprint, Syracuse and Akron were expendable. That's not a good situation for us to be in the long run. We have to turn that around. At the same time, we've been working proactively with Lockheed for decades, trying to help them manage their facilities, trying to build technology investments around them to make their campus more attractive. You recall several years ago a partnership with the State College of Nanoscience to build an accelerator, a nano accelerator out there right across from Lockheed's headquarters. So the state and the community, I think, have worked hard to be proactive with the company, but we have to work harder. Simple as that.
Good morning, Rob. My question goes to, you mentioned you get about 300 applications or proposals a year in the last couple of years here. What do you do in terms of helping to facilitate that the application is put in the right format so it has a competitive, that they're in the running? I'm sure there's a lot of companies that have good acts to expand with and everything else, but just don't know how to put together drafting the proposal itself that can be in the mix. Do you do any of that type of facilitation, or is everybody on their own?
No. There's actually a lot of that facilitation that takes place. The state runs workshops all over the region and in each of the counties within the region, at least one, if not two, workshops during the open application process. We have a lot of public meetings about the fact that this process is open and people are welcome to come forward. You know, I'll tell you, of the 300 applications we see, I'm probably aware, me as the chair of the council, I'm probably aware of somewhere between 50 and 60% of them, maybe a little bit less by the time they come in the door. So over that period of time, there are a lot of people who reach out and who ask for help. We certainly internally at Center State CEO, we help companies that anybody who calls and asks for support and guidance and assistance. And there are a lot of other organizations around the region that do the same. But it's very hard to help folks who you don't know are coming forward with an application.
You have a very short life so far in the business development, but you have capital jobs or the type of jobs that are not permanent but yet are high-paying in building these facilities. How many jobs have you gotten so far in the capital area, which are short-term jobs, and how many in the full-time? And what expectation do you have for this coming year, especially in the permanent jobs?
So I'm going a little bit from memory right now, but I think in the first two rounds, the total number of full-time private sector jobs created or to be created once these projects are complete from the applications we put forward is somewhere around 14 or 1,500. The construction jobs actually in the first two rounds are much higher. There's a couple of very large construction projects that had a significant amount of short-term construction employment. As we calculate our ROI, we look primarily at the full-time equivalents, and we look at a five-year payroll window. So what kinds of payroll is going to go out the door? So we're not just looking at the number of jobs, right, which is a metric that everybody can wrap their brain around, but it's not a great economic development metric. We're looking at what those jobs are paying also, which is a really critical component of how we evaluate projects. And this coming round, I think about 810 net new jobs from the application we just put in, assuming all those projects come to fruition, and I think there were somewhere around 700 or so construction jobs.
You mentioned the rebalancing of global income, and is there any hard evidence that due to this that manufacturing in particular has slowed to leave the country, or even some have returned?
Yeah, there is. If you look at some of the top line data about manufacturing in the U.S. and even manufacturing in the region, the trend lines are changing. They're softening. I personally believe that the next 10 years will represent a rebirth of sorts for U.S. manufacturing. I think there's a number of reasons for that. One, energy prices, right? Natural gas is abundant. The estimates are that by 2018, the U.S. is going to be capable of 100% energy independence for the first time in 50 or 60 years. That's a remarkable thing, and it has a massive geopolitical implications. The reality, though, is that energy prices in the U.S. are now relatively low and relatively stable. And that, as companies are looking at long-term capital investments that are in the ground for 30, 40, 50 years, the stability and the relative length of life on low natural gas prices is almost an arbitrage play for global companies. So I expect that they're going to be making investments. The other thing that's happening is the labor differential between other countries in the U.S. is changing, right? It used to be 20x China to the U.S. Now it's 5x. Within 5 years, it might be 3x. So the relative benefit that a company gets from offshoring jobs or of setting up a manufacturing facility in another country is now smaller than it once was, which means other factors start to come into play, like energy, like risk. Right? Political risk, economic risk, social turmoil, right? The U.S. is still seen, despite our confusing and ludicrous political system, is still seen as the safest place in the world to invest. So for companies that are looking to de-risk, the U.S. becomes more and more attractive. One final point on that, because I want to put a caveat to my remarks. I had the great privilege last week of going up to Oswego to cut the ribbon on a project that we spent 3 or 4 years of our life working on with Novelis, major aluminum manufacturer up there. It's a beautiful facility. What they're doing there is incredible. I know it's aluminum, right? How can aluminum be incredible? It's spectacular what they are doing with that metal and how they are innovating and how they are creating wealth and changing industries. That $220 million investment came with 100 new jobs. Okay? They have two lines that run in that factory. They're 3/10 of a mile long each. 24/7 operation. They're creating hundreds of millions of dollars in wealth a week on those lines. Five people at any given time it takes to run that line. So this is the challenge that we're up against. Manufacturing, I believe, is going to come back. It's going to look different than it did. And we just have to understand that, and we have to figure out how to adapt to it.
North Dakota. North Dakota has the lowest unemployment rate in the United States. The job growth there is dramatic. The investment is by major corporations. Have you looked into what's going on there? And where's what they're doing fit into your strategy for economic development in central New York?
So we've looked at it. It's a very good question. I mean, the biggest driver of growth in North Dakota over the last 5 years has been gas and fracking. It's been the biggest investment. And you all have certainly, I'm sure you've heard at various discussions here, the debate around that issue and the challenge that New York State has had and the passion on all sides of the issue. So that's a big part of what's been driving North Dakota. We're always out there looking at other communities and other states to see what they're doing, and there are some places that are doing really remarkable things. I actually think there's some really remarkable things that are happening in New York for the first time in a really long time that other people are starting to look at. This regional council process, by the way, was the first of its kind in the country to ask people to collaborate like this, and now other states like Tennessee and other places are starting to model it. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in other places.
Yesterday, WCNY had its grand opening of its new educational center mm-hmm. on the near west side of Syracuse. Are there plans underway to take advantage of this new center in what is a very diverse neighborhood in Syracuse?
So that project has certainly been not only that individual project of relocating WCNY to the near west side, but all of the development that's taking place around that project in the Case Supply Building and other parts of the near west side has been a major priority for the community for the better part of the last 6 or 7 years. And, you know, credit goes to Nancy Kanner and Marilyn Higgins and the people who really have been working on making that happen. Stepping back for a second, downtown's seeing massive investments like we haven't seen in a long time. The Near West Side has a coordinated initiative that's physically and tangibly changing the nature of that community, right? There's a lot of work that needs to be done beyond the physical landscape and capital investments with human capital, but there's a lot of good stuff that's happening. What Dominic Robinson's doing on the north side in collaboration with St. Joe's is world-class, and I mean this in all sincerity, it's world-class community-driven economic development that's happening. The east side is going gangbusters with investments from University Hill. And so what does that leave you with? Right? There's a part of the community that hasn't yet seen that same economic benefit. And that's not right. We got to figure that out. And as a community, it's not just the business community or the civic leadership or the political leadership, but as a community, we have to realize that that cannot sustain. And we have to, at some point, have a strategy and have goals and have people like myself be held accountable for whether we've been successful at building our entire community or whether we've just been successful at building parts of it.
Red Sea is finishing up the third year, I guess, this regional economic development, and the announcements will be made in December, I guess, as to who wins what. Will there be two questions. Will there be a fourth year, in your opinion? And there's a small piece of this whole project that's related to arts and culture. A small piece, $4 million for the state, not a lot of money. How much of a role do you feel that plays in central New York, and what kind of attention is it getting?
So do I think there'll be around four. Yes, I do. I mean, I think the governor's made a commitment to this process. It's certainly been high profile. I don't see him retrenching from it. I mean, I think the challenge every year is between the governor and the legislature appropriating the resources to make this happen. And provided you don't have a massive downturn in the economy and tight budgets, I do think the funding for this initiative will continue. I imagine, as it does every year, it will evolve a little bit. New initiatives will come up. And, you know, certainly there's a lot of attention now on the Startup New York program, which is another economic development tool that's been deployed. But I don't see the regional council process going away. As for arts and culture, you know, we've said it a million times, they're real anchors for our economy. I mean, you look at what's happening on Salina Street right now and how 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, people would point to the 300 block of Salina Street as the root of all ills, right? I mean, this was the thing that it didn't matter what was happening, Hanover Square, or Clinton Square, or Armory Square, Salina Street was a mess, so the community must be bad. I remember certain people writing opinion stories to that regard. At the same time, look at what's happening now. And that's been anchored by the Landmark Theater, right? The rebirth, the expansion of the Landmark Theater, more events downtown, more people coming downtown. So our arts and cultural institutions are really critical. I agree with you, David, the level of resources that have come through this process for arts and cultural organizations is probably not where it needs to be, and we'll certainly fight every year to make that more robust.
Rob, I appreciate your upbeat presentation at a particularly challenging time. My question goes to that slide about performance metrics. To what extent is the future of these grants dependent upon how the past grants are handled? Are there multi-year grants? Are there strings attached? Is there a risk that a grant could be withdrawn, or that future benefits could be jeopardized?
So the answer to all of those things is yes. The state has gotten, as have all states. I mean, listen, resources are scarce. Public accountability and transparency is the highest level it's probably ever been. So everyone is more and more conscious of the fact that when you put resources out the door, you have to make sure you're getting back what you were promised, right? I mean, it sort of makes basic sense, but, you know, everyone's coming around to that idea that it has to be a part of the thought process. So with the tax credit components of these awards that come out, the companies literally do not earn that tax credit or not pay that tax credit until they've made the investment, they've created the job, they've paid the dollars out the door to that particular salary. On the grant side, the tranches are usually two or three tranches, you know, of resources. None of the money comes in at the front of the project. It comes in after the companies have met certain benchmarks. So the 50% of the capital has been expended, 50% of the jobs have been created, you get your first payment, and so on and so forth. And there are clawback provisions if companies say they create all the jobs and then immediately take them all away. There are ways for the state to recover those resources, which I think is smart, and I fully support. There was another part to your question, though. The broader question was about how important are these metrics and how important is the success of those projects. And what we've been told by the governor's office is that 50% of their decision-making in any given round is about your plan, about the quality of your projects, and about the investments that you yourself are making in the community, right? The other 50% is your performance. How are you doing? Are you succeeding? All right, I showed you before, 92% of our projects are on track through the first two rounds, the highest in the state. We heard after we won in the second year that part of the reason we won in the second year was that our projects in the first year had performed better than any other region. Now, if you think about it, we're less than 2 years from the first awards being made. And by the time it takes to get grant contracts written and, you know, project disbursement agreements signed, you know, some of these projects are literally just putting shovels in the ground. So the performance story is one that we're really going to be able to tell more about over the course of the next few years. But it's something that is very clearly communicated to us as critical in the decision making.
I was glad to hear you say that you have an emphasis on agriculture, one of your emphasis on agriculture. And agribusiness, of course, is a part of that. So is the individual farmers collectively and what they contribute to the agricultural industry. They're not a part of an industry that's going to give you a phone call and say, we're moving. They're here.
Right.
What are you doing now to expand those efforts?
What are we doing to expand those efforts? I mean, certainly, I think if you look back at the types of projects that we've worked on, both inside this process and outside of this process, you know, agriculture and food processing have been a growing component of our portfolio, right? 5 years ago, the number of food processing projects we're working on were few and far between. Today, it's probably 25% of the projects that come across the transom. And we're seeing investments in yogurt, and we're seeing investments in cheese, and we're seeing investments now in meats, right? There's a big meat processing facility that went into the old that we were able to get in working with our partners up in Oswego, and the old Bird's Eye facility up in Oswego, pretty important. We're seeing in fruit. So we're seeing it across multiple components of our production economy, which is good. It's not just dairy, because dairy is challenged. I mean, there really aren't There isn't enough milk production in New York State now to support the volume of milk processing, and it takes a couple years to bring that online. But, I mean, that in and of itself is a remarkable story, if you think about it, because for decades our farmers were talking about the fact that they couldn't find a place to put to ship their milk, and now all their milk is accounted for. And part of the problem is that despite the fact that the demand for their product is at an all-time high, they can't charge any different for it. So they're not making more money now necessarily. They're making a little bit more money because of the volume, but they're not necessarily making more money now. The processors are making a lot more money. Anyhow.
Good morning.
I digress.
I have a couple questions, primarily focused, I guess, on downtown development, which we all know we see some exciting development there. But I'm concerned about what's happening below the ground in terms of looking at the cost of business, in terms of decaying inadequate infrastructure, water and sewer. Also, you passed by, you had a slide on broadband. It'd be mm-hmm. great to hear a little bit more about that. And will there be some leadership exerted in terms of trying to develop some kind of modern approach to infrastructure, information management, information technology management, so there's a better understanding of where fiber's available, broadband, where that infrastructure's available to reduce the cost of developing businesses in terms of sewer problems, addressing this kind of matter from a leadership standpoint? And then secondly, how far away are we from having a grocery store downtown, in your estimation, in terms of reducing the dependence on vehicles for people that do want to live downtown?
Okay, so these are both pretty straightforward. The first one, I have no idea. I'm sorry, it's not my – I mean, I know the infrastructure is a problem. It's not my area of expertise. I know that there are new ways to monitor and track, and you know before your water main is going to break. I don't know how to go about implementing that, but it's certainly something that I suspect that our – you know, the mayor's done a lot of very creative things over the last few years as it relates to planning and infrastructure. We know the city has its financial challenges. If there were more resources, we could probably do more. But it's something we're all keenly aware of. But it's an issue that's so large, it's scary and it's intimidating. I don't know how to go about giving you a better answer than that, unfortunately. On the grocery store, it's actually pretty straightforward. All the grocers that we've talked to, and we talk to them all, inside and outside the community, inside and outside the state, around the country, around the world, we've talked to every grocery store you can find. They want to be in downtown. They see what's happening downtown. They like downtown. Downtown does not have enough residents to support a grocery store. I'm sorry. I want a grocery store as much as anybody. What we're told by everyone who's come in and done a market analysis and by every real estate and corporate executive with every grocery store is 5,000 people, 5,000 residents in our downtown is the threshold for viability for a smaller footprint grocery store. And we're getting there. 3,000 plus. We're adding 400 new units of housing this year alone. We did that last year, too. We keep that up for a couple more years, you know, 1.75 residents for every unit, right? We're not that many years away from it. But we have not yet been able to convince any of these grocers to take that risk and being the early adopter. That does not mean we won't keep trying. We will. The conversations are ongoing almost every day. There are a couple of folks that are higher probability targets than others. The market's just not there yet. But the market's changing really rapidly. And one of the things that yesterday was a bad day on a lot of fronts. But I had a nice moment when I took this group of people from Buffalo and we walked them through the Pike Block, and which is a project you all know is near and dear to my heart. I've been involved in since I first came to town almost with 40 Below and other initiatives. that project tells a really interesting story in so many respects, but the rents they're commanding in, for those units on a per square foot basis are getting up to the point where you have a viable and robust and sustaining market, right? We've had to subsidize a lot of the downtown development over the course of the last decade, and I personally think it's been a worthwhile investment because it's tied to our bigger strategy of building from the inside out. But at some point, you want the market to work, right? You want the amount it costs to build a unit, the amount of cost you can get out of the unit to function. Close to that point, if not at.
Last question.
I'm so glad that you mentioned poverty as an economic development issue. And you had one of the things that you think about at night is the challenges of transportation. Working with the low-income community, it is such a serious problem. They can't afford to pay for a car anymore, and our transportation system really does not serve. Any creative ideas? Where are you going with this? Have you spent any of this economic development money on transportation?
I'm just going through the list of projects in my head to answer the last part of that. No, not specifically on transportation. We have spent it on broadband. We spent it on some water and sewer infrastructure, not specifically transportation. In part because there are other much larger pots of money out there for transportation in the state that don't flow through the Regional Economic Development Council process. That said, I agree with you. I talked about that spatial mismatch. It's a real challenge. You know, some of that is getting bus access to the places where people need it and making sure that access crosses the points where employers are. Those connections don't work all that well. I mean, DLI I talked to you about out in Cazenovia. You know, they're just across the border in Madison County, and you got a regional transportation system that can get someone out to the border of Onondaga County but can't get them the last 2.5 miles to the plant. And, yeah, so do we work with those companies all the time. Can they have short-term shuttle options and whatnot? But, you know, those individual one-off challenges pop up on a regular basis, and they're maddening. I mean, at the biggest level, what we need to do is we need to make sure that we're not making the problem worse, right? And I applaud the county executive. I think the leadership she's shown has been tremendous on putting her foot down on sprawl. Sprawl's hurt the community. It's built communities too, don't get me wrong. And I love farm country and acreage and being out in the woods as much as the next guy, maybe more so. But from a planning standpoint, it's harder to manage, it's more expensive to manage, and we have to get better at building density within our existing communities where existing infrastructure. And that's the city, and it's our suburbs, and it's our towns and villages. They're not excluded from this, but we can't be continuing to make the problem worse because we're having a hard time managing the problem we already have.
Thank you, Rob Simpson.